you could feel.
Or if you just want to lose 3 to 4 or 5 inches around your waist so you can look good in your wedding tux, then do it.
Yeah.
Whatever motivates you.
Whatever motivates you.
Whatever motivates you. All right, let's give out the number just a couple more times because we're going to wrap up here. Again, it's the Julia Loggins Happy Gut Pack. Yours for a contribution of $250. Well worth every single penny. And that money is going to help this radio station stay on the air and bring other voices like Julia, maybe bring Julia back on the air as well. 516-620-3602. The number again is 516-620-3602. Ask for the Happy Gut Pack. Okay, you get the USB drive with all of the audiobooks, the PDF version of it. You'll get to hear Julia. She actually walks you through every single part of this process. It's not that difficult. You're going to get these aha moments. You're going to listen to it and go, oh my gosh, that's what happens when I eat that particular thing or I drink that particular thing. Well, hell no, I'm not going to do that anymore. But you didn't know. Now you will know. You also get the her tips and tricks on how you can have a happy gut. Also the shopping list. She walks you through what she's going to basically say, eat this, don't eat that. So you know when you go shopping and you know what's in your cupboards, what's contributing to just that big belly, that big gut that's going on, and you're tired, you know, being tired and having no energy. Plus you get the powerful enzymes, you get the pH strips, all that for a $250 pledge. Here's the number one more time.
516-620-3602. The number again is 516-620-3602.
Give us a call, and if you are called, please remember there's a lot of people calling right now, so just be patient. The phone answers are answering the calls as quickly as they can. Julia Loggins, I want to thank you so very much. And if people want to find out more about you, the work that you do, and your clinic there in Santa Barbara, where would they go?
JuliaLoggins.com.
JuliaLoggins.com. Okay. JuliaLoggins.com. Check her out. Again, thank you so very much, Julia, for your generosity and for offering this amazing pack, the Happy Gut Pack, to our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Yes. You're fantastic. Wait, folks, you're going to have, now she's going to be your best friend. Okay. This is Christine Blaisdell. Keep the calls coming in at
516-620-3602. We are answering your phone calls as soon as we can, but please do call us right now. 516-620-3602.
I want to thank Julia Loggins again for being in studio with me. Stay tuned for more Fun Drive programming coming your way. Don't go anywhere.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away.
From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today.
The whole idea of creating any product, writing a book, or doing a documentary, is that you're trying to provide people with tools that will help them. I didn't create any products for the first 30 years of my career. I had books, I had articles, very serious articles, and some CDs and DVDs. And that was all the BAI offered. And then later in 2012, it's the first time I ever offered a product on, and that was because Bertold Reimers and Tony Bates asked me, would I do so? And when I thought about, okay, I'm going to create a product, why? And here's how my brain functions, because I'm always looking for solutions to problems. It's not that I deny the problem. To the contrary, as people listen every day for 42 years now on WBAI, I lay out the problem, just like today. I laid out a millennial talking about millennials and why they should not accept the fact that they're considered dumb and lazy and entitled and unmotivated. And he said, that should make you angry. You should let them know, no, I'm highly motivated. I'm very aware of the world I live in, and I'm going to participate. And it was an important introduction. And then there was another little audio clip from a young millennial talking about how her friends really are dumb. And they're, as far as the world is concerned, they're very bright about how to navigate social media, but they're clueless about the world they live in. But more, they don't care. They don't care about suffering or poor people or anything else, unless they're one. And then my guest was a brilliant individual, one of the smartest guys in America, and he's from Cambridge University and also University of Chicago, and he's a philosopher, and he is an ethicist. In other words, he's explaining to us what we have to do to change, and especially the younger generation, and very, very motivational, and some deep insights. You know, like it was Martin Luther King did not make the Civil Rights Movement. Civil Rights
Gary, everybody, but, you know, his show isn't due to be on until 5 a.m.
The same was true for
and I'm due to be on now, so I'm going to have to turn him off there. Now, aren't you all so glad that I turned it off? We're actually on the air.
Okay.
So, but we haven't started the show. This is. Remember how you said on your blog, pay no attention in the beginning is madness? This is the madness right now.
So where is the camera? This is the camera.
This is the camera.
The camera gets... Yeah.
And actually, it looks pretty good. You should see yourself because it says Mimi Mondal is watching. Now, I mispronounced it again, didn't I?
It doesn't matter.
No! People's names matter. You know, if somebody looks at me and says Jim Freund, I get pretty upset. It's Freund. Thank you. It's not Freund. So, you know, people should be...
I mean, there's a really famous, like, psychology person who is like has the same last name except one letter.
Yes.
So, I mean, people know how to
pronounce
that.
That's how I tell it. And, of course, my former best friend who created this radio show, her grandfather was Freud's co-author. Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf. Alfred Adler is the father of modern psychology. Freud was the father of modern psychiatry. So my best friend, who's now dead for almost 4 years, Margot started Hour of the Wolf to this radio show.
Wow.
So when I stayed at her house and when she went to Germany and various places, I lived in this little study that she had, and that study was Freud's room.
Oh.
It had his papers in it. That's, like, thrilling.
So, and you were the person who was almost Freud, but not.
Well, I was the person who, when we had three mailboxes, there was a fellow here named Bill Young, Y-O-U-N-G, and I arranged the mailboxes. Freund, Adler, and Jung. Okay, there's a person who went to university. This is our. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting at WBAI.org, and Facebook thinging, I guess it's casting, on my timeline, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. So you all have time to go there. But in the meantime, I think it would be a proper thing to start the show. If the bleeping equipment here lets me. There we go. Let's howl. We'll be right back. and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, a Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. Well, I promise you, we will have all of them tonight. Our guest is Mimi Mondal, and we will have a review done solo by Dan Persons, and a couple of words about our next reading, and alas, Garden des Rois. Stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I went into Solo, A Star Wars Story, debating whether I was going to discuss the film or, more interestingly, discuss how the tendency to round out the edges of a well-loved and long-running character can subvert the original image of the character, and frequently what made the person interesting to begin with. That's certainly the case here. Alden Ehrenreich, who assumes the role of the smuggler Han Solo, just learning his craft in this outing, is certainly charming enough and has a pretty good swagger to boot. But there was a dark magnetism that Harrison Ford brought to the role, even when he wasn't trying to act, that just isn't here. That is in line with the scenario given us. Han is a much younger man here. He has yet to be beaten down by the demands of his craft. We have Woody Harrelson instead to serve as the harbinger of what Solo may one day become. But Solo Light isn't quite as big a sell as the hard-bitten outlaw we were introduced to in the original Star Wars. But we can end the discussion there, because it turns out there isn't much need for it. Put bluntly, Solo, A Star Wars Story, isn't much good. Pretty much from beginning to end, the film exhibits all the earmarks of the very troubled production it was. In case you didn't know, the original directors, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, were fired both for dragging down the production schedule and for trying to bring a more improvisational feel to the production. Both those things are probably connected. And Ron Howard, not exactly anyone's first choice for this kind of thing, was brought in. By some accounts, Howard reshot 80% of the considerable work that Miller and Lord had done, but it's hard to tell. Best that can be said is that the direction is dutiful. It's got all the trappings of the Star Wars universe. It hits its marks in filling in the blanks of Han's backstory, all the way from the when Han met Chewie moment, to why he frequently talks directly to the Millennium Falcon, to clearing up that whole Han shot first thing. But it's frequently done in the most perfunctory way possible, and very often swaddled in an obscuring murk that makes it hard to see what's going on or read what anyone is feeling. Disney should really start paying its electric bill and get some lights in there. I would actually have preferred to spend time with Harrelson's Beckett, or with Lando Calrissian, played by Donald Glover, who manages to channel the spirit of Billy Dee Williams while making his own mark on the character, or with L337, a passionate, idealistic droid voiced by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who gets off the most provocative line about robot sex in cinema history. These guys have some juice to them.
There's lots of action in Solo, A Star Wars Story. There's some great effect sequences and some that are just plain confusing. But all over, it feels like something that everybody felt had to be done, rather than a thing that really justifies its existence. What the Thor movies are to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Solo, A Star Wars Story, is to the Star Wars franchise. You can love the character if you want, but his adventures leave something to be desired. There's no shortage of energy to Soft Matter, a new slapdash SF/horror film that just came out on demand. In fact, energy is pretty much all director Jim Hickox has in this ragged tale of a pair of scientists holed up in an abandoned hospice as they search for the secret to immortality, mostly by turning the leftover residents into lobster women and ambulatory garbage bags full of goo. There are intrusions by the goddess of the sea, a guy in a pretty impressive bodysuit whose dialogue is dubbed in by a woman, plus a couple of graffiti artists and a pair of pretentious hipsters who stumble into the place. The bag of goo gets a couple of dance sequences, after one of which one of the very white, very nerdy scientists won my heart by exclaiming, "Oh, Mr. Sachs, you've ruined your fresh kicks." There are adorably scribbled animation sequences, and most of the special effects are handled by the same kind of scrubby animation as well. It's a consciously, maybe self-consciously ragged affair, kind of like an art school version of those old films where the Bowery Boys entered an old, dilapidated house and encountered Bela Lugosi. And it's pretty charming for all that. Soft Matter doesn't have the budget for epic storytelling, but it doesn't need it. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. And I'm going to go see that movie, probably the Solo movie, that is, this weekend. And you know what? Yes, I hear your review. I hear the review of people like you who are less than ecstatic about it. And that's, and here's my take. Y'all are, have a very, very high bar when it comes to Star Wars movies. Well, let me just say, you can't get much worse than The Phantom Menace, okay? Whatever, the Attack of the Clones, I think, was the second film, was the second or the fifth, depending on how you're counting. Second in the canon. And the third film, I actually liked, like, the last hour. You know, so you could have compressed them all. But then comes Star Wars, and I don't mean A New Hope, because I saw that movie 30 times before, yes, fanboy, before it was ever called A New Hope. It was just called Star Wars. It wasn't until The Empire Strikes Back came out that they called it A New Hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, those two movies, that's the height that you have to reach. And people are, and I have to say that the last three of the new Disney branch, I thought were all pretty good. I liked, did you like The Force Awakens and its sequel and then Rogue One?
I liked all the new movies. I mean, I am one of those blasphemous fans that like the newer movies more.
I wouldn't say I like them more. But you see, that also, there's a generational thing happening there. Because I was of a certain age, off the air, on Facebook, but off the air, I was mentioning Margot Adler. Margot and I and our friend Gary Fried, who had come back from Texas after being like the only out person in all of Texas, right? And the three of us went to see Star Wars at the very, very first screening, which was a media-only screening. And the first, and this was at a theater, 70-millimeter theater, the Ziegfeld to be precise, doesn't exist anymore, then became the Lowe's it was at the Lowe's Astor Plaza, which doesn't exist anymore. Ziegfeld is still there. And that moment when the Imperial battle cruiser comes over your head with the THX sound, and that's how you first see it, that is an unforgettable experience. And then, and that to me is my favorite of the films, because that's a legendary moment. The second film, Empire Strikes Back, may be the better movie. In fact, not maybe, is the better movie. But it's the one that took the legend and expanded it into places where I had not gone before. So it's that first movie that is the high bar for me. And I think that The Force Awakens, which takes a lot of information from the first movie, I think it does a brilliant job of rebooting it in a way that Lucas was not able to do in the three prequels, because he was too close to the material. And also, Empire Strikes Back had another thing going for it, that it was originally written by Lee Brackett.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful story that was recently published in Den of Geeks, which I have posted on my Facebook page. People can go to my Facebook page. It's a public page. You go there. You can watch us right now. But also, you can see the link to this fabulous article that is all about the Lee Brackett script and how she turned in the first script, how different it was. It wasn't what Lucas wanted, but it was the first bash. And usually you do about five versions of the script before it comes a movie. But she died. She was an elderly woman. She had written The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks. She had written The Long Goodbye for Robert Altman. She wrote three or four movies for John Ford and movies for Howard Hawks. And she was one of the best pulp science fiction writers ever. And boy, did she nail it. Lawrence Kasdan saved the movie. Lawrence Kasdan took her script and saved it from oblivion. There were a number of things that she never put in there, but it was early days. But just how about the line, "Luke, I am your father"? That's Lee Brackett all over. So that is the high bar. Having said that, I still expect to, somebody online, Sean Guy's Vishniak, writes, Lee was also slated to write a Leia franchise novel before dying, which would have been published alongside the 80s Han Solo and Lando trilogies. So sad we never got to see Lee's Leia novel. Oh my, you are right. I never knew that. It sounds strange to me, because Lucas really didn't have the franchise going when Empire Strikes Back had begun. He was busy building Industrial Light and Magic. He had had such a huge hit unexpectedly with the first film that by the time Empire comes out and Lee Brackett comes on board, they were no doubt thinking of the dolls and toys and all that. And he was hiring other people to write novelizations, including our guest of 3 weeks ago, Chris Claremont, who wrote three books under the name George Lucas. Alan Dean Foster wrote the Star Wars books, and Chris wrote the Willow books. I liked Willow. They're making a Willow sequel! Anyway, fanboy. I'm off topic.
Yeah, so I became a Star Wars fan like much later in life, because So I am one of those fans who did not initially come from fandom.
Right.
And my first Star Wars movie, I think, was Attack of the Clones, which might be a little unfortunate.
Yes.
Also because I didn't know the background, and so I didn't know that it did not go chronologically, and it was just this movie, and I was like... I watched it when it came out, so I was maybe a teenager. I'm really, really bad at years.
You kids. Yes.
And I was like, I have no idea. Like, I have no idea what's going on here.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, the prequel trilogy was also a thing of my generation.
Right.
And
did you enjoy it?
So, at that time, I didn't watch the later movies because I couldn't get into it. I wasn't sure what was going on. However...
Yes, it's ironic that the prequels really are thematically sequels.
Yeah. So, however, when I later watched the original series, and this is where I may alienate a lot of people, I found Han Solo really annoying. He's stalks Leia around all the time.
Okay, somebody, I'm going to butcher her name again. I think it's her. Anamitra.
Yeah.
Says, ah, but the new Marvel comics are rather good, especially Darth Vader. And despite all my friends who work for Marvel, I've never seen them. Sorry, I like the Marvel movies. I love Chris Claremont. I had Scott Edelman on a month ago. I don't read Marvel comics. I'm just friends with them.
Yeah, I'm kind of comics ignorant. Yeah. Like, I appreciate it, but I'm not equipped to talk about it at all, like that medium.
Well, they are because they wrote it. Chris Claremont, were you at the Nirsif reading where Chris read 2 months ago?
I don't think so.
Mm, okay. Do you know who Chris is? I guess
very
not.
Very vaguely.
Okay, yes. For 19 years, he was he wrote something called X-Men.
Oh, okay.
There are 13 movies based on his writing. He pointed out that in Avengers Infinity movie, because it is an infinite movie, it never ends. There's only one character that he did not write at some point. Not create, but write. And that's Black Panther.
Oh.
Now, there's what, 20-something Marvel characters in that movie?
Mm-hmm.
He's written them all. That's who Chris Claremont. Remember, Stan Lee stopped writing in 1972. There's a handful of great people, of which Chris is one of the highest, and Chris was also editor of Marvel for a while. As a Scott Edelman, you have to meet Scott. He's at all the conventions. Do you know Scott?
I almost nearly know Scott. But...
yeah, we're going to have to get you to some more cons and introduce you.
Like, I was almost nearly on a panel with him once upon a time, but then we
ReaderCon?
Weren't. At World Fantasy, but I think he didn't make it.
Yeah, I don't make my way. Okay. Eric Saulstein is now watching on Facebook, and that reminds me that I better damn well promote what he's doing next Tuesday. So let me do that. I got off topic and I'm taking away from your airtime because I'm having too much fun talking to you. And you said you don't know what we're going to do. The show's a quarter over.
Oh.
Can you believe that?
How much is a quarter of an hour?
Over. We're 25 minutes in.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I said time flies. It does. So this coming Tuesday, June 5th, at 388 Atlantic Avenue. That's here, except we're on the third floor, and you're all going to be going to the first floor. And you're all going to be going, because this is a tribute to Thomas M. Dish that is being put together by Henry Wessels. We will have a number of, I think a good word might be celebrants, people who are going to be talking about Tom. And there are a number of people who have written things, homages that will be read in there. And Eric Saulstein, who just waved on Facebook, Eric has been working, 10 years, I think, on a film that is called Winter Journey, which is after a series of poems that Dish wrote. And he is going to introduce a segment of that movie for people to watch. We still have to figure out how to broadcast that over live stream, but we'll do it somehow. If, in the worst case, we'll point a camera at the screen if we have to. Eric, if you can, send me a video file of that, or just bring a thumb drive with you. But if I have it in advance, it would make things easier. You can send it to my email address, Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. In addition to Eric Saulstein, will be, of course, our guest curator, Henry Wessels, who has often worked on our tributes before. In fact, he started that tradition that we now do. The other people, okay, for those who don't know who Tom Dish was, Tom Dish was among the first ever to read for the Nursef Reading Series when that was created by Gordon Van Gilder, who's now the owner and publisher of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And 10 years ago was the last public appearance that Tom made at our reading series. His prose and poetry range from widely satirical stories to dark cautionary tales to YA young adventure, young adult adventure to amazing verse. Careful, I'm hitting the mic. Oh, idiot. One second. I have the wrong mic live. There we go. Now you can hit this mic all you want.
Yeah. Why is that mic on?
Okay, but wait, hold on. Talk to me again.
Yeah, can you?
And again.
Are we both audible?
Yes, now you're more audible. You were coming through this mic before. Whoop. Why is this one? No.
You were coming through that mic, I think.
No, I'm through this mic.
Oh, so I was coming through
that. Tap that mic. Okay.
Still not.
Wait, no, it was. Keep tapping. I found it. There it is. You hear the tapping now?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Great.
So that's your mic. Anyway.
So I'll be louder now?
You were, but the problem is I had all the mics up to make sure that you were audible. Now okay. I have just the correct ones up. Okay. That's because, by the way, let me explain to people, I'm using a mic stand for a camera stand. Yeah, right. In radio, we use camera stands. Never you mind. No, mind. Go to Facebook and look up my name, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, or go to Mimi Mondal's page, M-I-M-I space M-O-N-D-A-L, and you can watch us even as we talk. Okay, this is being put together by Henry Wessels, who's a writer and antiquarian bookseller in New York, and also appearing, Brendan C. Byrne, whose criticism has appeared in Rhizome, The Baffler, and The Intercept. He was a reader for us at the Nursef Readings, along with Rudy Rucker, which is science fiction royalty as far as I'm concerned. John Clute, reviewer, critic, encyclopedia writer, author, variously, who was friends with Dish since 1961, which is early. I met Dish in 68, and I will tell that story on Tuesday, so show up for that one. It's got a bang of a finish. That's a very bad humor, by the way. Dish shot himself.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Gregory Feely. Greg is Dish's literary executor. He's also a fine science fiction in his own right. Elizabeth Hand, the multi-award-winning author of 14 novels and 4 collections of fiction. She writes for The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Review, Village Voice, Salon, Real Simple, and the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. So she's slumming by coming with us. She's wonderful. She's been with us before. And, oh, me. I will be introducing the evening, and I will be telling a couple of Dish anecdotes. Also, I will be performing, oh God, I will be performing the short story, Fun with Your New Head, which is a favorite story. Frank Heller and I produced a radio version of it that Dish approved of.
So is performing like a more enhanced form of reading?
Yes. Yes, because the story is written like an ad. And heads are so funny, and there's so many fabulous things that you can do with your new, improved head. It will be in that fashion because it's supposed to be like this commercial. You buy
Oh my God.
Things you can do with your new head. So that it's a 3-page story. Today they would call it flash fic. In the day we called it a short short. And after intermission, Terrence Taylor will be reading a section from, On Wings of Song from chapter 11. So it's going to be a jam-packed evening of brilliance about a brilliant and wonderfully demented writer and human being, Thomas M. Dish, who hung around BAI a whole great deal, which is how I met him in 68. And, well, again, I will tell that story. Another person who was a friend of the reading series, he was live on the show only about 3 times, and the most recent time was over 20 years ago. But last October, he did appear for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Gardner Dozois. A wonderful person. If you wanted your life uplifted and you're at a convention, you sought out Gardner. He would make you smile or he would make you thoroughly upset and you would laugh at the way in which he would make you upset. And some years ago, like 12 years ago, he and his wonderful wife, Susan Casper, were in a traffic accident. They were in a cab, in the back of a cab. And it pretty much crushed various parts of Gardner. Susan was in a wheelchair for the rest of her life, and it took 12 years for the deterioration. Gardner died 4 days ago. And I have nothing else to say because I am very selfish. I am very whatever. I reject death. I don't like the idea of it. I think mortality sucks. And I don't like it when people are taken from us, as what happened all too early to Gardner. And we will have a show dedicated to Gardner Dozois. Hopefully Michael Swanwick, who is his closest friend, will call in, or probably via Skype or something like that. And I will play the reading that he did for us last October. I have little doubt that we're going to have a frank language disclaimer for that because, well, that's the way Gardner bleeping was. No eulogy this morning, just an apology for a lack of one, and not a shout-out, a scream-out. Sigh. Good morning, Mimi. Now we get to be, now that it's 1:33, we're 33 minutes into the show.
Wow.
Yeah. Did I say that it just... That's because I talk all the time. Don't let anybody get a word in edgewise. That's the secret to being comfortable on the ears. You don't get to say a word.
Is that better? I mean...
No.
I mean,
it's... No, it's bad. It's bad. People start... on the Facebook feed. They start saying, Jim, let her talk. And I go, whoops. Cherie Renee Thomas, wonderful writer, teacher, and former... Well, not a regular co-host of the show, but she was here many a time. And she was a former curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Oh, okay.
One time she was watching this on Facebook, and she just wrote, Jim, shut up and let your guest speak. And it was, whoops.
What if the guest doesn't know what to say?
Then I say good morning to them. Nick Mamadas is saying, hey, Mimi, what's your book about? She doesn't have a book. She has a story.
I do have a story, unless I have a nonfiction book, but I edited it. So
that counts.
Luminescent Threads, Connections to Octavia Butler, which is an anthology of people writing letters to Octavia Butler. And So I didn't write that book. Like, the only part I wrote was the introduction, one of the introductions.
But you edited the book.
Yes, I co-edited the book with Alexandra Pierce of 12th Planet Press. And so Alexandra had done a book called Letters to Tiptree before that.
Okay.
It's basically the same format. And I came in for the next book. By the time I came in, there was a call for submissions still going around, but quite a few submissions had already come in. So I did some edits. I largely did edits. And
Sean is saying, don't minimize your achievements. I agree. You co-edited a book. It was a letters to one of the greatest writers of science fiction of all time. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Let's leave it at that, shall we? What kind of... Now, who wrote these letters? Who were the correspondents?
So, started from... I mean, we had some very well-known authors. We had Nisi Scholl, who just spoke at the Rubin Museum. I came from her talk.
Yes,
earlier.
You know, you had told me that she was going to be in town, and I'm kicking myself for not having... do you know any idea how long she'll be here?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm going to write her. I had her on the air about a year and a half ago. I want to have her on again. We recorded under horrid circumstances. We stole somebody's office at Tor.
She's going to be this side again for ReaderCon. She's the guest of honor.
Of course she is. That's right. And thank you, Ben. I'll catch her at ReaderCon. ReaderCon is my favorite con.
I can't see the comments, by the way.
So I know.
If you want to read something out, just let me know.
Ben is saying, and where is it available?
It is, unfortunately, largely available online.
Okay. What's unfortunate about that?
I have a lot of people in India, right? I came from India, so most of my friends, my family, and a lot of them are not that internet savvy. Well, and they're like, which bookstore can we buy this at? And
Rahul,
the answer is you can't buy it.
Ramaswamy is internet capable because he's saying, hey, y'all. Do you know Rahul Ramaswamy?
I may have.
Well, they know who you are.
Hi, Rahul.
There we go.
By
the way, if anybody types at me and you don't want me to mention your name on the air, just say don't mention or something. Because people have, privacy issues. They may not want other people to know. What? I was at her AMA.
Yes. I did an AMA with the Bangalore Science Fiction Club, which is where I posted about your thing as well.
I saw that on Facebook. I don't know what the Bangalore Science Fiction Club is. And what is
it's a group. It's a writer's
group.
Oh,
actually,
yeah,
what Ben writes is, he says DNQ. That's good. People, if you don't want me to mention your name, put DNQ, which means do not quote.
Okay.
In front. Very fannish.
Huh.
So I'm sorry, the AMA is?
An AMA is what happens on Reddit a lot, where people ask you any question.
Oh, ask me anything.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I'm not on Reddit.
Not on Reddit either. Reddit is sometimes terrible.
Yeah. You know what? I'd like to move your mic. Place it a little bit more toward me. Come toward me. And then point it a little more at
towards
you.
Myself.
Like this.
Okay.
Yeah. No, don't move you.
Okay. Great.
And don't point that. It was fine.
It was fine?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll leave that up there. Whoops. Okay. Pardon us while we deal with...
I like my face taller than the microphone.
Yes, but the microphone likes to... that's good. We can point it up at you. That's fine. Except that this is the lowest.
Like, sometimes I like the dilution of tallness.
I am, for my American species, rather short at 5'4", But you're
I'm listening. For the human species, rather shorted, you know.
Yeah, I know people shorter than you, so.
So usually minors.
No, not necessarily.
Usually.
Yeah, depends on whom. There's some wonderful, well, actors out there. Ellen Page, Kristen Chenoweth is 4'11".
Hmm, okay.
Yeah, you know, they may tower in the industry, but they're not large specimens of humanity.
Right, your persona fills the room. Your persona fills the room.
Yeah. Tell us a little about yourself. You don't have much of a New York accent.
I've been here for like a year, so I mean, yeah.
Coming from where? I'm trying to get a little
largely bit. From Calcutta in India. I mean, I was born there, grew up there, went to college, and haven't actually been home in 2 years. And haven't lived at home maybe in 6 years or something.
Have you missed it?
I do, but I the way I express it is that I miss it in both time and space. So because Calcutta, I mean, I studied English, and most of my friends are no longer there. So when I go back, I often have my family and maybe one or two friends to really hang out with.
Yeah.
So it's not even the same city anymore. Like, I go to the same places where I used to hang out, and sometimes I'm hanging out by myself, and everybody else is younger than me, because like Calcutta has a large movement outwards for people for getting jobs. So there's a huge gap in my particular age demographic. So you see a lot of young students, a lot of college students, and then not a lot of people my age.
Right.
So it's going back is also kind of missing it.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. But there's the old saying, you can't go home again. I mean, I've discovered that just in New York. I live in Brooklyn now. I grew up in Queens, and when I go to my neighborhood, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a good portion of my neighborhood is now Indian. But it was becoming that way when I left. Jackson Heights.
Oh, yeah. Jackson Heights is largely Bangladeshi, so there are a lot of Bengalis.
Yes.
And there are like street signs in Bengali. And I mean, my mom.
And gold shops. And I used to buy all my technology there. And most importantly, food.
Oh, yeah. We Bengalis are well known for food.
Yes, yes. And justly so. I also like going to some of the South Indian restaurants that are there, where if you want spicy food, it's all vegetarian, but vegetarian is a wonderful cuisine if it's cooked well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, when you say spicy, if you mean flavorful, I'm all for it. If you mean hot, I'm not so
good. For me, I like hot, but if it's not flavorful, there's no point to the heat, if you follow
me. So the first time I left India, I went to do my second master's degree in Scotland. My mom was like, great, you can eat mashed potatoes forever and be happy, because I can't eat spicy food.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, I mean, I went there and I was like, oh my God, people just eat everything with salt and there's no chili in anything. And this is heaven.
Yeah.
Which is not the general perspective.
Yeah. So what brought you to the United States?
I really didn't know what to do with myself. That's not a good answer, is it?
No, it's a good answer. It can be elaborated upon. But no, I think it's a, you know. Okay, let's turn a little bit. At what point did you start writing?
I actually started writing really, really young. Like, I was writing at like age 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And initially I was writing in Bengali, because I wasn't, like, my family isn't very fluent in English. And maybe I made the switch around age 14 or 15, But then, I'm like 30 now, and I've written a lot of random things, articles, you know.
You were at Uncanny writing nonfiction.
I wrote one article for Uncanny, then I edited poetry and nonfiction.
Oh, so poetry. I'm sorry, you were an editor at Uncanny.
For a while.
Right.
So in India, I also wrote poetry. Like some of my earliest creative publications were poetry almost 10 years ago. And I'm really glad no one can find that on the internet anymore because they're not... Okay, I will not be self-deprecatory, but maybe I'm still really glad no one can find them.
Yeah, I could find them.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Because they are with the name Mandy, and you can never find a thing by a Mandy.
Oh, you have hidden them under pseudonym.
No, Ria just called me Mandy. I used to be called Mandy. So, it's not entirely a pseudonym. It's just a name that you can't find anymore. And I went to a high school called Calcutta International School.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Mandy from Calcutta International School from 12 or 13 years ago. No, you can't find that on the internet.
Okay.
People have tried.
And as Anna Mitra and myself would say, ha-ha, that's what you think. Well, we won't get into that, but there's archive.org there. Once something is on the internet, even if the website is taken down and disappeared.
No, it's not taken down. It's still there on the internet. It's just really hard to search
for.
Just
obscure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just obscure.
So
if you use Mimi now and you were Mandy, may I ask what name you were born with?
Okay. I was...
If you'd rather not, don't go.
No. It's not a dead name. It's just a name. So,
well, I'm just saying, any issues I bring up, just say, next question, you know?
Yeah, so in the Bengali community, as in some other communities of India as well, we're given a formal name, which is usually longer, and then we're given a nickname at the same time at birth. But the formal name is the only one that's registered. The nickname is the one that your family calls you. So my formal name is Monideepa Mondal. And I also have some publications with that name. My nickname is Mimi. So I was actually given both at birth. And my family calls me Mimi. And Mandy was a name that showed up at some point.
Yeah.
So, it's also an organic name. Like, people actually did call me that. Some friends called me that. But, yeah. One of the reasons I stopped writing as Mandy at first was I actually learned that that's not discoverable and that's a thing. And it also obscures your background. And maybe that's not something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I came to terms with that fact. Started publishing as Monideepa Mondal. Not a very common name, especially because I come from the Dalit community. So you won't see the name, especially the last name Mondal. You will not see that very often, just because, fairly underprivileged community, not a many of us become writers. However, given that it's a really, really uncommon name, what are the chances that in India there's another author called Monideepa Mondal?
Yes, exactly.
With a different spelling of the name.
Uh-huh.
But given that we're a non-anglicized culture, our name spellings are kind of flexible. Like, sometimes if people see a different spelling, they may think it's still the same person.
Yeah.
And this Monideepa Mondal, who, different spelling, she went to the same college as I did. She's also from Calcutta. And writes a slightly different kind of things. I think she mostly doesn't write fiction, but she wrote nonfiction, lifestyle articles, travel articles. And I kept getting congratulated on her articles. Like, somebody would just be like, your article on traveling there was great. And I was like, I've never been to that place. And so I thought, what else can I do so that I keep not getting conflated with this author who is a little senior to me? So she has more work and earlier work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, I do have a nickname, which maybe isn't that bad. I used to think it was horrible. I thought he was hilarious,
mm-hmm.
But so yeah.
By the way, one of your clarion teachers is watching. I won't say who, but hi.
Is it Andy?
No.
Is it Susan? Yeah. Is it Eileen?
Yes. No, the second one.
Is it Susan?
Yes.
Hi.
One of my favorite writers.
Hi.
But anyway, it's probably not right for me to out people who, although anybody who's watching on Facebook sees who else is watching. It becomes an open community and they chat with each other and all that. So it's not a secret to those people who are on Facebook. But at any rate, at what point did you start writing, or did you distinguish even what could be called imaginative or science fiction or fantasy?
So, as I mentioned... I started writing in Bengali, right? And I had also started reading in Bengali. And Bengali is one of the languages, like in India, which picked up genre fiction really early in the 19th century or something. So, I mean, most Bengali authors have written, say, a horror story. Nearly everyone. They write all realism, a few horror stories. And there's detective fiction, there's tall tale fiction, there's science fiction. And we kind of just read them in school.
Do you remember, I remember hearing about in the 1970s, in the mid-70s, there was, it was either a mathematician or an astronomer, Bengali writer, who wrote some hard science fiction that got a relatively good translation into English and was highly celebrated, and I now cannot remember.
Is that Bose, Jagdish Chandra Bose?
I think it is.
19th century?
No, modern. Around 1970.
Around 1970.
Yeah.
Jayant Narlikar?
I don't think so.
Does anyone know the answer?
Yeah. Maybe if somebody does, they can call in or type it into Facebook or send me an email. But it's just that I remember reading.
Yeah, I now feel a little terrible because I wrote a history of Indian South Asian science fiction and fantasy. Yeah,
This was actually space opera. And I may be not remembering it well. Huh. You know, I mean, I'm talking about the 70s, and those of us who are at WBAI in the 70s, shall we say, maybe we liked the colors, you know? It's
in the 70s and maybe the early 80s or something, there were pulp magazines in Calcutta based on the Gernsback magazines.
Ooh.
And
wow.
When I was at college, I was at Jadavpur University, my Professor Abhijit Gupta was making an archive of them so one of their publishers, like one of the people who published those magazines, he had only one copy each or one or two copies each, print copies left. So he wouldn't let anybody take them out of his like publishing office because he had them like in plastic bags. So I was recruited by my professor to take a flatbed scanner and my laptop in my backpack, go there and sit there and scan those magazines.
Oh, that's way cool.
And this magazine,
I mean, it's a lot of work, but on the other hand,
this magazine, it was called, the one that I scanned was called Bishoy Science Fiction, and Bishoy is the Bengali word for wonder.
Ooh.
So it's called Wonder Science Fiction. There were others. There was actually one called Amazing Science Fiction.
Okay.
There was another. I think there was something called Astounding or something. But so they're like literally.
So Wonder and Astounding are John W. Campbell style names, and Amazing, of course, is Gernsback.
Right. And these magazines, there's this very interesting story after these magazines, right? So how did these magazines come to happen in, 1970s India? Now, as you probably know, I mean, India after independence was a Soviet-leaning country. And India only got globalized, per se, in the 1990s, early 90s. So in the 70s, it was very hard to get these magazines in India. However, the 60s brought hippies.
Yay. I mean, oh.
Yes. And a lot of these hippies brought their science fiction magazines. Then they would get, well, they would get tremendously wasted and spend all their money, and then they would sell off their science fiction magazines to second-hand bookstores.
Right.
And some people would go and buy those magazines. And that is how they came to find out about this kind of science fiction, where, you know, this stuff was not even coming to India at that time. And they literally...
So they were reading it in English?
They were reading it in English. They are, like, educated people. They're just, like, not getting these things from America because they don't distribute in India, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, this gentleman whose name is Ronin Ghosh, he was the one who edited Bishoy Science Fiction. He said, we would put up classified advertisements in Bengali newspapers, okay, saying, science fiction writer wanted. Write to us at this place.
Ooh.
And then they'd get like letters for people saying, what is this thing? What is Kalpo Biggan? Kalpo Biggan is the Bengali word for science fiction. And they would explain to them. And I remember this
one. Now, are they conflating when they say science fiction here? When I, for example, say science fiction, I use it to mean fantasy, science fantasy.
Well, no. These people were mostly thinking of just science fiction. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, one of the sentences that I remember is that, so he said, he was telling me that we'd get all these people where, because we have put up this advertisement saying that science fiction writer wanted will be paid. And somebody writes to them and he's like, we train them to write science fiction. Like, we tell them, we give them a few stories. And he's like, this is the sentence I remember. How can you train somebody who's never been on an aeroplane to write about rocket travel?
Ooh.
Like, they have no concept of this thing. They've never seen it. And you're making them write science fiction. And sometimes the few people who wrote the magazines used pseudonyms to write themselves. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so these pulp magazines they existed. Then they petered out.
Yeah, I had no idea. I had no idea. So why did they peter out?
Mostly lack of funds, I guess. And also maybe because...
Just like in the US, yeah.
From the 80s or something, like one of the big changes that happened in overall in the Indian literary landscape was that vernacular language literature kind of receded. It became more and more English language literature.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you take a look at the South Asian science fiction and fantasy history that I wrote, after a point you see that there are not many significant regional language writers. And, like, from the 80s and 90s, you start seeing people writing more in English. And, yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, the demographic changes with, you know, when the language flips over, a lot of things flip over, right? I mean, people who are really good at writing in Bengali may not be that good at writing in English.
It strikes me that there is a profound lack of American publication of science fiction. We are... The U.S. is so insular. We had so many books that were, you know, the best of the year. Gardner Dozois started
mm-hmm.
one. Judith Merrill had one of the best in the 1950s, but she also put out a book called The Best from the Rest of the World. And she was one of the first people to get people to translate or to acquire stories from other countries. You know, Stanislaw Lem, his stuff mm-hmm. is never published here until, you know, 10 years after. And even today, there are profoundly, at this point, his better books have been retranslated. And the same for Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, two Russian writers.
Right, right.
But there, you know, I could not name a whole bunch of Indian writers. I don't think I have ever seen an anthology of Indian science fiction. I've seen a little African. I have seen a lot of Asian.
There is a TBA announcement, which happens to be TBA, so, you know.
Ah, Does this mean that you're going to have to come back and do the A part of the TBA?
I could.
Yeah, okay. I think you're going to have to do that.
I mean, it's mostly TBA because I haven't replied an email that I should have replied a few days ago.
Ah, we can play a cut of music and you replied right now. No, it's not fair.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
okay, somebody says Amitav Ghosh's Calcutta Chromosome is a good one.
It is, and the funny thing is I mean, who says that? No, it's a novel.
That's Sean.
Oh, yeah. So, funny anecdote about Amitav Ghosh's The Calcutta Chromosome. Amitav Ghosh is largely a mainstream fiction writer. First novel, that is his first novel, and it was published by Penguin, I think, worldwide. And he was actually advised to not call it science fiction because Indian authors apparently didn't sell as science fiction. And this is one of those things about diversity. I mean, science fiction really didn't care about non-white authors for a very long time.
Yeah.
And given that India has a fairly large footprint in the mainstream fiction scene, I mean, a lot of authors from India choose to just go to that side.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right about science fiction for the most part until recently, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And still have to get a real foothold. Although thanks be that it's starting to happen. And I think commercially is going to accelerate. But it's not just that science fiction was so white-bread and insular and ingrown to its own detriment in so many ways for a literature whose business it is to look forward, to in fact be just looking at its navel and into the past. But also, in addition to that, even for Americans, a lot of writers, Kurt Vonnegut,
mm-hmm.
Jonathan Lethem, many fine writers were told, do not call your stuff science fiction because your book can either sell, 5,000 copies to the people who read science fiction or 200,000 copies for the people who read literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vonnegut actually went full out and denied that he ever wrote science fiction. And
didn't Margaret Atwood also do that?
Oh, yes, she did. And Ms. Atwood, as much as I admire her writing and her intellectual prowess and analysis of literature, got trounced by the great Ursula K. Le Guin on that issue. Ms. Atwood, well, no, actually, she's taking it back now because she recognized what Le Guin was saying to her. These were done in letters and speeches and all that. It was wonderful, not an acrimonious argument. It was a brilliant, fabulous argument by these two masters of intellect, Le Guin and Atwood. And so much fun to read. And it was only about 2 years ago. Before Le Guin's unfortunate departure. By the way, Malini is saying hello.
Hi, Malini.
And Arunuva brings up a name that you are going to talk about a great deal.
Satyajit Ray.
You see, I didn't even have to say it. Now, I have been aware of Ray's, I don't want to mangle the first name, science fiction writing for, 90 minutes, 2 hours? In other words, thanks to you. I know his movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of his movies, depressing though they may be.
That's because you haven't seen the science fiction movies, which are young adult movies largely, but they're also critical of politics and fascism and things like that. So those
are
the fun movies.
Those I have not seen. There were years. I mean, you're talking about insular. The United States didn't. New York was the first place to start showing Indian cinema in the United States. Maybe there was some in the West Coast, but very little. And Ray's films were widely acclaimed. There were two or three theaters in all of New York that showed his stuff until Indian communities, or Bengalese communities anyway, started forming in Queens, like in Woodside and Jackson Heights. And then there was, you know, one theater in all of Manhattan. This is before streaming. This is, you know, when you wanted to see these things.
However, I mean, what I'm speaking to is that, I mean, while I like Ray's serious movies as well, there are certain expectations of certain cultures that people have, especially in America or in the West. Like, you know, people want to see beautiful Indian poverty movies rather than Indians having fun movies.
I'm sorry, I'm the other way around.
But yeah, but that's like the cultural expectation that, you know, poverty porn. I mean,
which is why Slumdog Millionaire, which is not an Indian movie, but Slumdog Millionaire,
which is immense poverty porn. I mean, else is there in that movie?
Well, exactly. And that's why it was so popular. And that, yeah, but poverty porn is such a great term for it.
And I didn't make it up. It's a term.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't heard it before. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect.
Like going to third world countries and taking pictures of beggars and saying that, oh my God, it's so beautiful, that person sitting in the street. Yes, that's poverty porn, and
yeah,
that's a thing.
I mean, reminds me of some of Nancy Kress's science fiction, which she, you know, talks about the ultra-rich people walking among the poor, handing out her Beggars in Spain series. I don't think she made up the concept of beggars in Spain, but if you see somebody on the street starving, do you feed them or not? So it becomes an intellectual.
Or do you feed them on camera?
Well, that wasn't a choice in the book. Now it's a whole trilogy and a bunch of stories that she wrote of beggars in Spain. But that could also be called poverty porn, except that it's not so much about poverty. It's about these people who become insular and won't see beyond because of the poverty out there.
That's not porn. Like, it's poverty porn when you get gratification from watching it.
Yes, exactly. But it starts with that premise.
Right.
And then shield it off. And a viewer has a comment, going back to Ray, saying he also did a first draft. Oh, okay, this is something...
Everyone knows it in India.
Yeah.
Please read it out if you want to.
But this is something that you very specifically told me before we went on the air, which Arunava Banerjee, am I saying this more
absolutely correctly?
Wow. Jeez. Says, and this is something you were telling me before I went on the air, he also did a first draft treatment of what many say became a direct, and he puts in quotes the word inspiration, which is the term I advised you to use for, finish the two letters.
Oh, Spielberg's E.T.
Yes, exactly. Or what was it, Spielberg's E.T., or do you think it was Ray's E.T.?
Huh.
Your personal opinion.
I mean, no one exactly knows what happened there. Like, it's a story that a lot of people in India know, and some people in Hollywood know. So, I mean, Ray was both a science fiction writer and a detective fiction. These are the two big series that he has. And
I have so much reading to do.
So, I mean, there are translations of his... I mean, he's actually probably the most translated Indian science fiction author.
Mm-hmm.
So I can find new anthologies. So his detective...
I would like the names of some anthologies.
Sure.
Yeah.
So his detective stories, some of them he made movies out of himself. Because detective movies, they are easier to film than science fiction. Science fiction is expensive. And... So the anecdote mostly goes
and
that
especially with Ray's style, which is goes back to, you know, what we call noir, very very stark images, black and white.
But he also did a lot of innovation with special effects, because obviously he was working with a lot, with a very small budget.
Yes.
So he did do a couple of supernatural movies, not his own writing. So at one point he had to show ghosts in the dark, like flickering in the dark. And this is a black and white movie.
Yeah.
And he's like shooting at long distance. And I think, was it fireflies, like something like that. And how do you make that firefly special effect happen at no cost?
Well, your tools.
People running around with lanterns
In
the dark. So, I mean, he actually has a book on filmmaking technique as well. So he's like one of those like few polymaths.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a time when he spent a few months in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, as it were, and he had a lot of meetings, and then he came back, and no movie happened out of that. And after that, and by this time he was also pretty old, and he kind of grew disappointed and strange. But obviously, like you didn't see. I mean, this was back in the 80s, 90s, yeah. Right?
So, which is just about the time Americans, at least, were starting to realize that there was a genius among us. I don't mean among U.S., but he was being recognized in the art theaters, yes.
Yes.
But not the genre work that you're talking about.
Yeah, so, I mean, he came back and, I mean, this never came into the newspapers or something very clearly what exactly happened in Hollywood, who he talked to. I mean, people used to not give very candid interviews back then.
Yeah.
So the rumor goes that he had a script, and the script had something like a young boy in the countryside, in Bengal countryside, coming across an alien, and the alien gives him special powers and things like that. And this alien is like a short person, big head, you know, skinny arms. And this script apparently stayed back, like it was like circulated. I mean, maybe at that time there were like photocopies, right?
Right.
And then a few years later, E.T. came out. So, I mean, no one knows if he met Spielberg. No one knows if Spielberg directly lifted from that thing, or maybe he heard the story. Maybe it just became Chinese whispers.
Well, there are a lot. You know what happens is scripts go to Hollywood and they circulate.
Yeah.
This is how it works. And very often the people reading them honestly don't know
who it came from,
the provenance. Now, there was a woman who sued Spielberg over E.T. P.S. she lost. But this kind of thing happens all the time. Now, you're going to have a reading for us, and we should probably get ready for that, because believe it or not, it's 2:15.
So we have 45 minutes.
Yes, and we have to do some music outro, and I think it's a good opportunity now to play a cut of music.
Sure.
So that we can prepare. And for those of you watching on Facebook, and I'm very gratified to see a rather large community out there. That's your doing, Mimi.
India has a lot of people.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, yes.
Like Indian fans, I've been telling anybody who'd listen. Indian fans are
large. Which is why, and you will agree that I spoke to you about this a month ago. I asked you about the possibility of how we're going to get regular segments from you on this show. Editorials, things you wanted to talk about, world building. We have so much to talk about. So you'll be on the show several times, aren't you?
Okay, sure.
Ah, okay. You all heard that right. She's committed now.
Ouch.
Ouch, she says. We are going to play a piece of music that in no way, shape, or form refers to India, but does refer to something that Mimi likes a great deal.
Oh.
The performers are Steel Eye Span.
and drink. We are the MacMacFeed, we'll vanish in a blink. We like to go stealing, we like to drink and fight. We are the MacMacFeed, faster than the light. We are faster than the light. No king, no queen, no master. No king, no queen, no master. No king, no queen, no master. We free men. No king, no queen, no master. We'll not be fooled again.
Rivers! Okay, so you just heard We Free Men from the album Wintersmith by Steel Eye Span in collaboration with Sir Terry Pratchett. And earlier this evening, Mimi Mondal, who was our guest tonight, and I were talking about the joy of Terry Pratchett. And that is the Tiffany Aching series. Is one of my favorites of his various different series. And Steel Eye, who does much of the music I play on the air, not very well known in the U.S., but they're known to me. Steel Eye collaborated with Pratchett about 3 or 4 years before his death on that album. And then after that, we heard a couple of cuts of music from the movie Sonar Kela. Mm-hmm. And did Ray actually write that music?
No, I don't think he did the music himself.
Okay, but, somebody, although it's attributed to him, somebody is asking, Mimi, do you chod? C-H-O-D?
That is an obscene question.
Well, I beg your pardon.
And I have no idea who that is.
Okay, fine. Then I will...
Somehow, audiences from my country always throw up people like this who...
That could have been local. You know, we don't know where... It's Facebook. We don't know where these people are from. At any rate, let me reintroduce the show, saying that, number one, you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City. WBAI at 99.5 FM, also over WBAI.org, and for the next 40 minutes still on Facebook Live on my page, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and my guest this morning is science fiction writer and editor and, as I said, pundit, without knowing what the word, I didn't realize that the word pundit had a Bengalese background.
Sanskrit background.
So a Sanskrit background.
Like all Indian languages, yeah.
Yeah. And it, sorry, I just had to deal with something. So I'm actually pleased that it was a more than appropriate, meaning, of course, expert, somebody who is, you know, when if somebody wants to comment on something literary, political, scientific, that the kind of people, a pundit is the kind of person who you go to for quotes to learn from. They are experts.
Oh my God.
And in my mind, somebody who has so much to say about so many things, and you are certainly one of those people.
Who don't shut up?
Well, that would be me also, but I'm no pundit. No, maybe I am, but I don't think I'm right. Well, in science fiction, I'm a bit of a pundit, but that's about it. At any rate, you have fiction that you are going to read for us. Is there anything that we need to know before you begin?
So about the story?
Yeah.
The story...
Don't move to the mic. A mic will move to you.
The story is called This Solid Earth, Our Home, and a lot of my friends who are listening in have probably heard this already.
We have many people who...
Yeah, so I wrote this story...
We're reaching conservatively 30 or 40,000 people at the moment, so
wow.
That's conservatively.
So I wrote it in 2014. It came out in early 2015, my first pro publication. The reason why I'm reading this oldish story is that I keep writing these characters. So there are other stories with these characters that I kept writing. One of them will come out on Tor.com in 2019, actually.
Okay.
Because Tor takes forever. But they also put in like really nice art and other things, so it's worth it. The wait is worth
it. Do you know it's doing the art yet?
No.
Yeah, that's always exciting to find out. And they do lovely. Is it Irene Gallo chooses the art?
I think so.
Yes.
She commissions someone to do the art, but she does the
deciding. But she's,
deciding.
I think, the art editor.
I think so, yeah.
As it were. Irene, I want you on this show. I meet her all the time. She's wonderful.
That would be lovely, yes.
Yeah, wouldn't it? And we can show all the pictures on the... I don't care.
And like every time I've spoken to her, which is not many times.
Have you met her?
Yeah.
Good.
It's like concentrated knowledge. Like, yeah. Like, you remember the things
but that
she's
also hear. Just a cool person.
So, yeah, I mean... And also, yeah, I mean, I would love to hear more from the art perspective here, from the writing perspective.
Let me just say to listeners that the internet feed in the room in which we are broadcasting from is spotty. So the Facebook Live event is disconnecting every so often, as it just did. Bear with us and it will reconnect. And I know that you can't hear us right now because you're probably on Facebook. But may I suggest that you attach a tab of your browser to WBAI.org and you can listen to us there. It is, after all, radio. So having said that.
So this story, I mean, I keep writing more characters from this story, and...
Let me just repeat to the internet people, because we just came back. Hey, David, that the internet feed cuts in and out here because of our crappy connectivity. So I suggest that in addition to watching, go to WBAI.org, or if you're in the New York area, tune in 99.5 FM. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mimi.
So this story, and also just because I like it, like these are stories that take place in a, in or around a circus troupe going through an early 20th century India. So they're like little travel stories, and they have monsters and other people.
Cool. One of us.
So this is from the middle of the story. The story itself is like about 6,000 words, but this section has two little stories within stories. And tell me if I'm like going over time or something. Okay. Our new companion is a talker. As we cut across the bustling town, he points at things and tells us anecdotes about them, bemoans the conditions of the local transport and garbage disposal, offers to buy us excellent chai at the roadside stall he favors, until we get to the highway that leads northwest out of the town. Then finally, quietness. Nothing but the clamor of birds and in the trees over our heads. Shehzad Marid gets bored, sulks, whistles, skips along the way, rolls his eyes. He returns to Johori and says, I never did understand why he let people call him the Padri Sahib. Considering that he never went to any church, there is no church in Deoband. Perhaps he was a churchman in his previous life, Johori shrugs. And you know about it. Nothing. Our guide is unrelenting. Why don't we do it this way, Johori Sahab? I tell you the reason why Deoband is unlike any other small town you have seen, and you tell me the story of the Padri Sahib's life. It will keep the children entertained. They have a long way to walk. Johori never tells stories. Even from when we were younger, we don't remember being told tales, sung songs, read news from the papers. Nothing to do with the lives of other people. Very well, he says. And so, Shehzad Marid begins his story. Once upon a time, children, a long time ago, there was no town in this place. The land was covered with heavy forests, populated by tigers, elephants, bears, all manners of ferocious beasts. And here, by the side of a lake, there was a village, and a few rice fields for the villagers to eat. A few dal fields, vegetable fields, or whatever it is that people ate. The village was poor, semi-secluded. No different from other villages that dotted the forested highlands. A village that would fall through the cracks as other more prominent parts of the country were awash with a great wave of change. What great wave of change, you ask? Well, our story takes place around the time when Qutbuddin Aibak took over the throne of Delhi, and his Mamluk armies invaded all the lands from the foothills of the Himalayas, or the Himalayas, as Americans call it, to the lower plains of the Ganga. That was an author comment. Shehzad did not say that. Invasions were not rare in this period, but the Mamluk invaders were unlike any other that came before them. They had come from far off Afghanistan or even further west, and brought with them a religion, language, and culture that had nothing in common with the people of this land. The village of our story also came under these invasions, but there was little for armies to invade there. An occasional band of soldiers would ride by and make off with a sheep or a pretty-faced girl, or some traveler would seek a night's rest on their way to elsewhere, but life in the village was largely untouched by changes in the world outside. until one day a warrior on horseback came riding on the heels of another. On a mound overlooking the village, the first warrior fought, slew, and buried the second. But the villagers barred their doors and looked away. This fight was not theirs. They gave shelter to the victor when he rode down to the village and sent for their doctor to dress his wounds. But none of them clearly understood what the man kept babbling about. He was speaking of God and demons and fire, again and again of fire. But the gods and demons that these people knew did not behave the way he described. He said he needed to build a masjid, a house of worship, on the mound where he had buried his combatant. And the villagers thought the man a fool, for there was nothing but forest up there, for no one in the village shared that man's faith. And who built a holy place over a corpse anyway? The man was severely burnt. He had hardly any cuts or stabs from his battle, but the burns were so bad that chunks of flesh had melted off his bones, horrifying people at sight. And he gave off an unbearably delicious aroma of meat. As the man kept babbling in his delirium over the next few days, the villagers were confronted with an unforeseen hazard. At first, cattle started disappearing at night. Then one night, the villagers woke up to find one of their rice fields burning. After that, in the houses, young men and women started having violent frothing fits. Dung was found smeared on every house front one day. Old women became pregnant. The village chief's wife shamed their entire clan by walking home naked after a bath at the pond and could not remember any of it afterwards. The villagers offered prayers and sacrifices at their temple, but the torments continued. Eventually, everyone came to conclude that it was the burned man, the one who threatened to defile their land by building a house of worship of his alien faith, who brought this ill omen upon the village. He was not a man, but a deo, a trickster spirit arrived to lure the righteous from the path of faith. So the villagers turned him out of their village at sundown, even though he was visibly too weak to survive in the forest. Later that night, there was a forest fire some distance from the village. They never saw or heard of the burned man again. The hauntings did not stop. Objects randomly caught fire and burned down houses. People went into frenzies. Children were born who could remember their past incarnations or cleared the tops of tall trees in a leap. When a family arranged a marriage, they did not know what they were inviting into their homes anymore. The Islamic invaders had brought many new people into the country. In the following months, the forests became a route for not only wandering soldiers, but merchants, administrators, clerics, men of fortune, ladies in palanquins with long entourages of servants. New people started settling in the village and nearby. Business flourished, and the village grew, but the mischiefs of the deo continued. Much later, like decades later, a saint of the Sufi persuasion happened to pass through the village. As soon as this pir, that is the word for the Sufi saint, heard of these occurrences, he identified as signs of jinn activity. People understood each other's speech a little better by this time, so the peer was able to convey to the villagers the necessity of building that mosque, the one that the burnt man had suggested decades ago. What that luckless warrior defeated on that mound was a man driven by an ifrit, a jinn of fire, the very worst, the peer told them. The grave of his master chained this ifrit to the vicinity of the mound, and he was thoroughly peeved. Only by building a house of worship over the grave could this malice be contained. So they built that mosque, and the village that grew into a town came to be known as Deoband after the binding of its malevolent spirit. But that was not the end. The pair had come many years too late. For other genie of various element had by this time arrived and settled in the village. They had planted themselves among the people, taken their corporeal forms, mated with them, been buried in their earth, to the extent that it was difficult now to distinguish human from genie. The mask restrained the worst of their kind, but the genie would now always live in Deoband. They became a part of the life in the town. They owned property, opened businesses, stood for elections, sent their children to schools and the newly built university. The humans no longer say anything. The jinn have less to do with the humans now, as long as the humans don't interfere with their affairs. The genie is by nature a nomadic creature, little ones. But the jinn of Deoband have lived on this land for centuries. They have built up legacies and traditions, just like humans. And they don't like to see those traditions upturned. They also have their own feuds and enmities. And there is the story I promised to tell you. Shehzad gives us an emphatic smile and bow. Now it's the turn of your uncle. Johri is not our uncle, but he shakes off his silver jacket and preens his slicked back hair and says, "Fair enough, I will start. Do I have the time?"
Yes.
"Listen to this story well, for I will not recite it twice. Gregor Johann Mendel was born in a family of poor German peasants in a borderland known as Moravia in Western Europe. Poverty was his great misfortune, for he was a man with an exceptional mind. So, in his early 20s, young Gregor decided to no longer impose on his family's finances and joined the Augustinian monastic order. Monasteries in Europe have for ages been significant repositories of learning. Gregor was a mild, charitable man with no desire for a wife or worldly possessions, though he doted on his sister's sons. He was initially appointed as a school teacher and soon sent to university to refine his skills. He expected to have a predictable life of a monk scholar. Unfortunately, again for Gregor, at university he developed an interest in a subject that made his church superiors uneasy: the transmission of hereditary traits of creatures through breeding. When he attempted to breed a group of rats for his experiments, his superiors objected. Thwarted, he was reduced to working with bees, which he had learned to breed as a child in his father's farm, and the common pea plant, with which he made some incredible discoveries. But acknowledgement kept eluding the gentle amateur scientist. His findings received no appreciation in Moravian scientific circles. He never met or heard of Charles Darwin, the other European scientist working successfully on theories of inheritance at that time. Moreover, his failure to improve as a teacher resulted in him being transferred to the administrative side of the order. He was made an abbot before he turned 50. In the dark winter of his 61st year, Gregor Johann Mendel had an epiphany in the chapel of St. Thomas's Church in Brunn. It was late in the evening, a desolate day. The abbot was bent before the altar, alone, murmuring a prayer, shaking from the fevers induced by the renal disease which he knew would consume his life. The moment was ushered in by a voice calling his name. He raised his eyes first to the crucifix in front of him, but the voice that summoned him was at his back. He turned to find a man of about his own height, but so completely wrapped in a greatcoat and a woolen hat that it was hard to discern his features. "Father Gregor," called the stranger again, "I have traveled a long way to see you. To seek you, I'm sorry. With great difficulty, the abbot stood up. He had grown gaunt and pale, much like a tree through these weeks of ice. What is it that you wish for, my son? Perhaps the man required to make an urgent confession, but it was not so. He motioned instead towards the chapel door. I have heard much about your scientific work, said the man. Will you walk with me in your garden, father? Father Gregor acceded to the odd request, pulled his cloak tight around him. The gardens were ill-lit, silent, the earth dusted with snow. The beds where he had once nurtured his pea plants were unkempt, overgrown with weeds. The bee house he had painstakingly built at the back of the monastery was deserted. The bees having fled to fresher hives, he had nothing of his life's work to show to the visitor. Father Gregor's stunted breath misted over his eyeglasses. Your children perish in your neglect, Father Gregor, said the visitor, tantalizingly. The people under my charge are my children as well, responded Father Gregor, with pain. And you have dedicated to them the better part of your life. Give your other children the rest. The old man sighed. You ask for more life than I have left. Then may you be mistaken, spoke his visitor. He extracted a bundle from inside the breast pocket of his coat. Perhaps this gift will assist your will to live? He began to unwrap the cloth that held tightly the contents of the bundle, pausing before he removed the final layer. In the faint moonlight, Father Gregor could already see the objects. They looked like a pair of human infants, shrunk and misshapen. They wriggled, and the thin, high-pitched wail from their throats was muffled only by the cloth cover. Father Gregor's face became a mask of surprise. Ah, could these be the true Mandragore? Agreed the man, whispering. I was given to believe that they were mythical. Merely extremely rare, said his visitor. I won't be overstating if I say I risked my life to obtain a pair. But imagine the kind of work you can do with them. The very thought made Father Gregor feel light in the head. But why would you trust these dearly obtained treasures in my hands? Our intentions are the same, Father. I, too, would like to learn the many possibilities of the true Mandragore. If it can be bred to adulthood, if it can be made to walk or think like humans, whether its wail can be trained into speech. The man smiled. But I have none of your talents. And I have not the time, alas, said the abbot ruefully. I can literally feel death's hands tighten on my throat. That can be rectified, said his visitor. He unleashed a small knife from his belt and in one swift movement unwrapped a little wrinkled foot of one of the mandragores and snipped off a small chunk of a toe. He held the slice up to the horrified Father Gregor and said, chew this carefully. Make sure you soak up all the juice, then swallow the gristle. Father Gregor recoiled. Take it and chew, Father, repeated the man forcefully. It's only a slice of a root. It will grow back. Fascinated, revulsed, Father Gregor put the thing in his mouth and did as he was bid. The taste was sharp, too sharp to reckon any actual flavor, and the essence of it seared through his digestive tract like hot lava, as if burning away all the rot and sickness inside. With a jolt, Father Gregor sensed his spine shoot up straighter, his eyesight focused back into clarity, and the chronic pain in the lower back that he had suffered for the past 3 years unclenched like a pair of giant fists. He was put in mind of his university days in Vienna, when the entire world had felt new and unraveling like a blossom in spring. You have to feed them back your blood if that lets your conscience rest easier, said the man. The mandragores require a drop each day to survive, strictly no more, besides a bowl of fresh milk to soak them. Repeat this ritual every day until you have found faithful earth to plant them. They will become your true children, blood of your blood. He proffered the bundle, now once again securely wrapped in cloths, to Father Gregor. But my life here, my abbatial seat, how long would you have given yourself before I came to see you? Not long, I'm afraid. Perhaps a few hours, perhaps a few more days, said Father Gregor, uncertainly cradling the bundle in his arms, as he had once cradled his sister's children. I was preparing myself to embrace death. Then I will remain in your stead for a few more days and embrace death when he comes looking, said the man. The stranger, as he removed his greatcoat and hat and placed them on Father Gregor. With his face finally revealed, it startled the abbot to find how much the other man resembled him. He was even dressed in an Augustinian priest's habit, as if he had already come prepared for this moment. He reached out for the father's eyeglasses, now useless to him, and placed them upon his own nose. Go now, Gregor, John, Mendril. Waste no time, and may you fare well in your quest, said the new abbot. He turned and started to walk towards the light of the chapel. As he stowed his newly acquired treasures in the pocket next to his heart, pulled the hat down low over his face and dissolved into the night streets of Bern, it occurred to Gregor Johann Mendel, now no longer a man of God, that he did not even know the name of his benefactor.
You've been listening to a section from This Sullied Earth, Our Home, read for you by the author, Mimi Mondal, here over WBAI, New York. Hour of the Wolf continues now. I am Jim Freund. With me, the author Mimi Mondal. One of our Facebook viewers, listeners, wants to read the rest of that story. And by the way, Upu is saying namaste to you. Upu Raoul.
Okay. I don't know.
Well, you don't know everybody out there.
I know.
But they're saying namaste, so we'll say namaste
back. Okay, namaste back.
Yes.
And so the rest of that story is available on the Juggernaut Books app, which it costs like 30 rupees, I think, which is like 50 cents.
Is it available in the U.S.?
It is available in the U.S.
In English.
But it's, so Juggernaut Books has its own native ebook platform.
Ah, okay.
But which can also be read on like a browser. But I mean, yeah. So it came out in 2016.
On a browser, does that mean that could be also done through a phone or a tablet?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so most people can access it.
Yes, and so the fun thing about these stories is that in these, I use a lot of like, I mean, fun thing for me. It may not be a fun thing for anyone else.
It sounds like fun for me. You say that these are characters you keep revisiting.
Also, the city, this town with the djinns, it exists.
Okay, so how do you chain an ifrit?
Ifrits and marids are two different kinds of djinn.
So marids, I don't know. Ifrit.
So you know a marid. Everybody knows a marid. The genie in Aladdin is a marid. So a marid is a water genie. And an ifrit is a fire genie.
Yeah.
And the latest fire genie
you
may have seen is...
You say genie or
djinn? Djinn is the plural. Ginny is the singular, which is how it becomes genie in Aladdin. It's the same word, right?
Yeah.
So, Shahzad Marid, who told the story, is a Marid, which shows in the story. The last time some of you maybe saw an Ifrit was in American Gods, the TV show.
That's right.
So he's that dad dude is a fire genie.
Yeah.
So he's an Ifrit. This guy, the Aladdin guy, is a water genie.
And in the book, I think the Ifrit story is even more amazing. I liked the adaptation on American Gods of that character.
It's one of my favorite novels.
But in the Neil
novels.
Gaiman books, yes.
Yeah.
I have read it now three times. First time as a novel. Second time with a browser and another... with the book, I'm sorry, and a browser next to me so I could go to Wikipedia and look up every mythical
all the
god,
mythology. I
all
have done that too. Yeah.
And then the third time with the 10th anniversary edition, just slowly for the love of it. We'll see how the second season goes now that the people who created the show have walked away, Michael Green.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I am but, like so up, not on, not up on
yeah,
so the, much
the,
news.
No, they left the show like early fall. And Michael Green was one of the scriptwriters, and I'm blanking on the name of the other person who created the show, but one of my favorites. But there's some guy named Neil Gaiman who's coming in on the show. And we'll see if he can interpret the thing.
Okay.
We'll see if he's any good. He's currently finishing, American Gods. The thing he co-wrote with Pratchett.
Good Omens.
Yes, he's finishing the TV version of Good Omens. I recommend, by the way, the radio drama of Good Omens, It's on the BBC. Go to the BBC website, BBC4. You can listen to it.
I may have heard it. I have heard
you
it.
You have heard
yes.
it. Yes. Yes, the first or the second version. The second version is the winning version. At any rate, it's fun. I don't think it's Gaiman's best work. I don't think it's Pratchett's
that
best
is,
work.
Oh my God, you're the only other person who thinks that. Except me. Like, I think... I mean, everybody else loves that book, and I don't dislike
it. I enjoy
it. Yeah, I don't dislike it, but I like their individual works better, and that's, like, I think the only other person who agrees with me. Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay, we're totally in sync on this. That also goes for a lot of Douglas Adams' work. I told you off the air. Oh, you do have to watch the TV, the American TV version, believe it or not, of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Okay.
That was done by Max Landis for two seasons. It was wonderful. It's been canceled. because there were people who, referring to Max Landis, said "me too." So that could be a problem in his being hired, which is a shame because he's been doing some brilliant work. A listener, a viewer, says, "Mimi, your story is compelling. Now I have to go get the rest of it." And absolutely,
Juggernaut books.
Yeah, Juggernaut books. Well, would you, I told you the time would go quickly. How much time do you think we have left?
I have no idea.
About under a minute.
Under a minute.
Under 1 minute. Well, I have to start my outro theme because this guy over here, Lister, wants to begin Burn Baby Burn Clapper, which is the next show coming up here over WBAI in New York. Why he wants to start his show even vaguely on time is beyond me, other than he does a brilliant, wonderful show. But let's not deal with trivialities like that. Mimi, where... what do you have coming out? You have something from tour.
So, yeah.
You'll be on the air again.
Shahzad Marid happens in the story that will come out from tour. That is in 2019, though.
Ah! Oh, you'll be on this show several times before 2019. We're going to see to it. By the way, one person says that they love the color of your hair. So do I. It was different the last time I saw you.
Thank you, yes.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
And it's like it's already started going because this color doesn't last long.
But it morphs. There's something nifty about that.
Yeah, yeah.
At any rate, again, our guest is Mimi Mondal. That's Mondal. Ask for her by name. Search the internet, find her articles. She's rather interesting on the air as well as in print. And hey, you can watch this show again on Facebook or listen to it over on the WBAI archives. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much, everyone, for listening in.
Absolutely. And this person is going to be back on our air more than once. So it seems. It has been decreed. Oh, there goes Lister. You know, you were talking about poverty porn. This is Lister porn, everybody. There he goes. Yeah, look at those abs. Okay, everybody, be good to each other because people deserve it, okay? If you're not good to each other, you end up like Roseanne Barr. And I usually don't disparage people, but there are exceptions. I will be back. Blah, blah, blah. I will be back next week from 1 to 3 a.m., probably with some recording and thoughts about Gardner Dozois. Come Tuesday to the Tom Dish tribute. At 388 Atlantic Avenue, 7 p.m. Admission is free. We look at you cross-eyed if you don't donate, but you can stand that, right? Good morning. Take good care.
leave you with no matter what I said, with the last words on my lips. And I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, or that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech and the First Amendment. So
fag and burn.